In today's episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast, the science of the runner's high, is vitamin B12 megadosing dangerous, how to track every element of your fitness, best natural foods for babies, healing the skin naturally, and is creatine safe?
Welcome to the BenGreenfieldFitness.com Podcast. We provide you with free exercise, nutrition, weight loss, triathlon, and wellness advice from the top fitness experts in the nation. So whether you're an Ironman triathlete or you're just trying to shed a few pounds, get ready for non-run-of-the-mill, cutting-edge content from BenGreenfieldFitness.com.
So I was standing around just minding my own business, just checking my email on my phone.
Yep, and, as you do.
Yeah, and what pops up? But a photo of 16 vials full of blood.
Oh, yeah.
What the hell, dude? You got to warn a guy before you open something like that.
I went into the lab this morning and gave 16 vials of blood. I took my kids. I think they almost passed out because there was so much blood flying around in the lab.
Looking at the photo, geez.
For what it's worth, I signed up for the Wellness FX premium panel. And that's
the premium panel.
The way they describe it is they say it gives you VIP level access to every biomarker we offer, including performance, heart health, advanced thyroid, omegas, systemic inflammation, and all male reproductive health hormones, along with omega-3 fatty acids. What else do they have on there? Fibrinogen, thyroid, cholesterol, metabolic hormones, complete blood count, and advanced nutrient profile. Like pretty much the full meal schmeal deal. And
it is a VIP. This is not Joe the Plumber's blood panel.
We'll put a photo for folks.
This is Kanye West's blood panel.
Let's put a photo for folks of all the blood tubes up on the show notes. What is this episode number 279? BenGreenfieldFitness.com/279. And I will, as I am prone to do for folks who are who have the Ben Greenfield Fitness phone app or the premium podcast, I'll do a follow-up podcast with what the results show. But in the meantime, I once again have my Zevia soda because I've heard that it's very important to dump a bunch of nutrients into your body after you give blood. So what better to do that than with soda?
What flavor is it this
flavored week? By Stevia. This flavor is called Dr. Zevia. It's like Dr. Pepper, except flavored with Stevia.
Sweetened with sweet stevia.
Sweetened. But stevia isn't a sweetener. It's just a...
Yeah, I guess.
It's just...
Some people actually, it tastes sour too.
It's a root made out of fairy dust. We all know that. Mm. So this podcast is brought to you by Dr.
Fairy Dust.
Zevia.
Oh.
Fairy Dust.
News flashes.
Twitter.com/BenGreenfield is going pretty crazy, actually, mostly with book stuff lately.
Crazy.
All the really fun people are taking awesome photos of themselves with books. And then, of course, we feel compelled to retweet that. Yeah. But in between all the book photos, there's been some really cool studies that have come out that you've been highlighting there as well.
Yeah. And by the way, I should mention that for those of you who have been going to your bookstore and grabbing my new book, Beyond Training, or going to Amazon and getting it, we do have a place where you can upload photos. And if you just so happen to go ape nuts and order more than one book, if you go to BenGreenfieldFitness.com, or actually no, BeyondTrainingBook.com, the other website, the other URL, BeyondTrainingBook.com/photo, and you upload a photo of you holding more than one copy of your brand new book, then you get to take part in a 2-hour Beyond Training video workshop with me. So check that out.
You've accidentally jumped into the special announcements, I think, here.
Well, actually, I purposefully jumped into the special announcements. So
good work.
Yeah. So anyways.
One thing I'd like to say is I wish you had named the book Training and Beyond.
Mm.
That's the only complaint I have, because then we could actually like do something like this every time it comes up.
Training and Beyond
in the 21st century.
Anyways.
And that would be way more fun.
Let's talk about news flashes.
Yeah, let's do it.
We've got an interesting study that was highlighted over on the Biohacks blog at biohacksblog.com, one of my favorite new websites for super nerdy information.
Yeah, I didn't know that existed. Cool.
Well, this article was about how red light exposure enhances endurance performance and sleep quality. Now,
I knew about sleep quality, but I've never heard about endurance performance.
Mm, yeah, me neither. But this is why I've actually gotten for, I don't know, it was like $6 or $7 off of Amazon. I got one of those infrared lamps. And I just have a light stand next to my bed, and I plug the lamp into the light stand, and I turn it on at night. Not only do I get the infrared light exposure that I can have shining in the room while I'm reading at night, because I like to read a book that kind of settles me down when I'm lying in bed at night, not a Kindle or an iPhone or any of these blue light producing devices that shut down melatonin, but just like a basic light. And I shine it just a little bit away from my eyes, so it's not blurring right in my eyes, but I'm getting some of the light hitting my body. And by the way, when combined with a nice sexy Pandora channel in the bedroom, it does create a good sexy mood too.
I was going to say, if you had the light trigger some Barry White at the same time, like you turn the light on and it goes, oh yeah.
Yeah. And I'm actually not even, not even joking. It's warm and therapeutic, but it kind of makes the bedroom a little sexier too. So
yeah, I'm getting a little tingle just thinking about it.
So that's okay. Oh. You're creeping me out now. Yeah. Anyway, so back to this study. What they showed was that when they took these athletes and they exposed them to red light for 14 days for 30 minutes before they went to bed at night, what they found was that the sleep improvement increased compared to a placebo group that didn't get the red light exposure, but that when they took these athletes out and had them do a Cooper test, which is as many laps as possible as you can do on a 400-meter track during a 12-minute test period, the groups who were exposed to the red light actually experienced increased performance in the Cooper test, covering over 5% greater distance over the 12 minutes. And
crazy.
What the researchers said, and I quote, "Based on studies, we can infer that red light treatment contributes to increased melatonin secretion in the pineal gland and muscle regeneration. Although more studies involving phototherapy, sleep, and exercise performance need to be performed, red light treatment is a possible non-pharmacologic and non-invasive therapy to prevent sleep disorders after training." So it's interesting. There's a few little things here. First of all, better sleep quality. Next, better sleep quality after hard training. And finally, improvement in the actual quality of the training itself. And that's all for just a $5 to $6 500-watt infrared heat lamp that you can get off of Amazon. So
that's really cool.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. What else is cool is another study that was in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research that was a little bit close to my heart, because I've always been a fan of, well, not always, but in the past couple of years, been a
the
fan.
Time you were born.
The time I was born, of hypoxia, and specifically.
It's a weird thing to be really into.
I know. It is weird. It's a weird fetish. It used to be shoes. Now it's hypoxia. Anyways, though.
And you're not talking about autoerotic hypoxia.
This study looked into acute apnea swimming. So they would take swimmers and they had them do low frequency breathing to the point where they actually had a drop in arterial oxygen saturation. So, for example, the way that I personally do this is I get in the pool and I do 10 sets of 25 meter swims underwater or freestyle without breathing. And the reason that I initially got into this was evidence that I'd seen in the past that hypoxia can actually increase the production of hormones, specifically growth hormone. And one of the ideas behind this is that a hypoxia, or long periods of time spent in the absence of oxygen, may actually cause a little bit of muscle damage. It's got like this hormetic effect. And to repair that muscle damage and allow your body to become anabolic, you get a release of growth hormone and potentially some other hormones, such as DHEA. Now, what this study specifically looked at was testosterone, cortisol, and DHEA, and they compared regular breath swimming with hypoxic swimming. And what they found was that even though there wasn't a significant effect on testosterone or on cortisol, there was a significant increase in DHEA, which is a highly anabolic hormone in both men and women, and one that I tested, incidentally, when I went in to give my 18 or 16 tubes of blood this morning. Anyways, it's a highly anabolic hormone, and it was increased with the hypoxic swimming versus the regular breath frequency swimming. So what this means is that not only could hypoxic swimming potentially cause an upregulation of DHEA if it's something that you would include once a week or perhaps after a swim workout or even, you know, jump into your pool after you've lifted weights at the gym or something like that, but there may be an effect of some of these other things like the, you know, the elevation training mask or the power lung or any of these other resisted breathing devices or, you know, potentially just holding your breath until you're blue in the face.
Yeah, study's not saying that you have to be swimming.
Not necessarily.
It's more about the doing something but without oxygen.
I find it's for me, I feel the best when I do it after I've done it when swimming. So I've been putting it onto my recovery day. So when I have an easy workout day or an easy recovery day, I try and do things that still get me fit. So for example, today, Wednesday, is now a recovery day for me. It didn't used to be, but now that I'm doing this SEAL Fit training, Wednesday is supposed to be an easy day. What that means is not that I'll sit on my butt podcasting with you all day, Brock, as much as I'd love to do that.
That'd be but, so fun.
I will do a couple of cold showers today, and I'll make them longer because I have a little bit more time to kill because I'm not working out. So I'll do 2 5-minute cold showers at some point today. So I get some cold thermogenesis and some of the cardiovascular benefits of that. Mm-hmm. I will do 1 sauna session where I'll go sit in the sauna for about 30 minutes and read a couple of magazines,
using the hell out of your
sweat.
Body.
Excellent article, by the way, over on Tim Ferriss's website this week. I don't have the link handy, but we'll put it in the show notes to a ton of the metabolic effects that occur when you expose yourself to heat in a sauna setting. So I'll do about 30 minutes of sauna, and then after I finish the sauna, I'll hop in the shower at the gym, I'll go jump in the pool, and I'll do 10, I might even go as high as 20 of those hypoxic repeats for that DHEA effect that'll help my body to recover faster. And so the other thing I'll do is a foam rolling session. So this is a recovery day for me, but I'm doing foam rolling, cold thermogenesis, heat training, and then also hypoxic training. You know, a lot of these underground training tactics that I talk about in my book. And all of that means that I've made myself a better person physically and from a performance standpoint by the end of the day without doing a traditional, you know, quote unquote workout. But this this acute apnea swimming study was really interesting, and I'll link to it in the show notes for folks who want to check out the actual study.
Not only is it effective, but it draws attention to you in the pool as well.
Mm. There you go, because you're the only guy who's blue in the face.
Yeah.
And then finally, I mentioned a couple of weeks ago about this new form of iron made by Thorn FX called iron bisglycinate. And it's a highly absorbable form of iron, which is interesting for athletes. You know, speaking of hypoxia, athletes who tend to get anemic-like symptoms, which is huge, especially among endurance athletes, low hemoglobin, low storage iron, low ferritin, etc. But the problem with a lot of these iron supplements is that they can be constipating, which is extremely uncomfortable, no matter no matter how much Zevia flavored soda you drink, it won't fix the constipating effects of iron supplements. The interesting thing is that related to that, a new study just came out in the Journal of Nutrition that looked at the effect of iron supplementation on exercise performance. And this was one of the first studies of its kind that directly looked at, you know, whether or not, you know, not just iron-containing foods and not just sedentary individuals, but an actual iron supplement and exercising people. They took women specifically. They had them exercise at the highest level at which they could achieve maximum capacity, 100% exertion, and they also had them exercise at submaximal exertion. and women who were given the iron supplement were able to perform any given level of exercise at a lower heart rate and at a higher efficiency. So this was one of the first times I've actually seen it fleshed out in research that even in the absence of something like iron deficiency or anemia, iron supplementation may actually help, especially people who are training at high levels. So I thought that was interesting. I'm going to put a link to that particular study from the Journal of Nutrition in the show notes, along with a link over to this newer form of iron, this iron bisglycinate that I think that folks should check out if they tend to get winded climbing a flight of stairs or kind of want to improve performance from an anemic standpoint. So we'll put all that over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/279. Well, if you're tired of spending hours on cardio with minimal results, then listen up because I got a game-changing fitness breakthrough for you. The Carol Bike, science-backed, time-saving solution trusted by experts for optimizing health and longevity. They use a special form of a workout called a rehit, which allows you to achieve superior health and fitness benefits compared to regular cardio in 90% less time. That's amazing. That's a lot of time, 90%. Studies show that by doing Carol's 5-minute workout just 3 times a week, you can improve your fitness by 12%, reduce your risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and even wind back your internal body clock by 10 years. The science is clear. Carol Bike is your ticket to a healthier and more vibrant life. You got to try it to believe it and to see what I'm saying. I mean, it's not like a walk in the park. When you're pushing hard in those intervals, you're pushing, but then it's just like over and it's done and it walks you through it. It's very motivating. It's 5 feet away from me right now. It's right here in my office, my cool little exercise toy in my office. So you get $250 off your Carol Bike. You don't have to wait any longer. You can join over 25,000 riders and visit carolbike.com today. carolbike.com. Well, if you're like me, you live a busy life. You don't really have time for many days off. That's why I talk so much about your mitochondria, because they generate about 90% of the energy your body uses. And keeping your mitochondria strong is one of the best ways to keep fatigue at bay. But these little mitochondria, darn things, are expensive to run. They use a huge amount of raw materials, especially when it comes to minerals. The problem is most people, including you and me, probably don't get enough minerals. And without minerals, your mitochondria don't have the cofactors they need to make energy. More than 97% of Americans don't get enough potassium. About 80% are deficient in magnesium. 40% are deficient in calcium. And those are three of the big ones. There's close to a dozen other trace minerals that are important for mitochondrial function, and most of us don't get enough of them, and you definitely can't get them from, say, table salt. It turns out that trying to take all the minerals you need by taking single mineral supplements isn't only hard because you need a ton of pills, but it's not the most effective way to get your minerals. That's why I take liquid, humic, and fulvic complexes. These are full spectrum mineral supplements, which means you get all the essential minerals your body needs in one go without a daily handful of massive amounts of pills or very large capsules or anything else that's hard to swallow. I use Beam mineral supplements because they're almost 100% bioavailable. They come in a liquid form that's easy to drink. It's just 2 bottles. I keep them in my pantry, throw back a shot a few times a day. They're a great way to refill your mineral stores, especially for those of you out here who are haunting your sauna on a frequent basis, or sweating, or doing hot yoga, or anything else. Keep your mitochondria running strong. So if you want to up your mineral game, give Beam Minerals a try. Go to Beam Minerals, B-E-A-M, minerals.com, and use code BEN at checkout for 20% off your first order.
Listener Q&A.
Hello, Ben and Brock. My name is Celia, and I'm 54 years old, and I've been running since 2012. There have only been a few times where I've experienced a runner's high after either a training run or a race, and I've been unable to come up with a common denominator on the provoking trigger. Is there a way to increase my chances of creating one? Although I usually don't have too much of a problem getting out to train, it seems like it'd be a very good motivator on those days when I need an extra kick in the butt to get out there. Also, what is actually going on in the brain at the time of a runner's high? I love listening and learning from you both. Thanks, and have a great day.
You want to get high?
Have you ever seen Towelie on South Park?
I actually have not seen that one.
Oh, it's the little towel that always wants the boys to get high. And they never want to get high. It's really good. They're always like, no, Towelie, we don't want to get high.
You guys,
That's my big South Park impersonation and all I can do.
You guys.
So
that's pretty good.
Let's talk about the runner's high, though. The runner's high is kind of interesting. So the hypothesis of the runner's high is based off of several studies that have shown that you get endorphins, or what are called endogenous opioids, released during intense physical activity. And it doesn't just have to be running. Even though chronic repetitive motion, because of the actual shift into alpha brainwave production that occurs during chronic repetitive motion, can be more likely to shift you into that high or make you more sensitive to these endogenous opioids.
So you could be working on an assembly line and get the same sort of thing.
Technically, although it does actually have to involve something that would require or that would make sense for those opioids to be released because they blunt pain. So if it was highly aerobic or
physically some exertion.
Yes, if it took a great deal of physical exertion on your factory line, then yes. The idea here is that those endogenous opioids bind to the opioid receptors in your brain, and one of the things that they do is they help to blunt pain, as you might be experiencing during a long workout like pounding the pavement. Hmm. Now, they also – these opioid receptors, they act in reward-related areas. So there are a couple areas of your brain called the striatum and the nucleus accumbens, and both of those are reward-related areas of your brain. And in those areas of the brain, these opioids can inhibit the release of inhibitory neurotransmitters that would make you tired or sleepy so that you're not, you know, getting excessively fatigued during exercise. And they instead increase the release of dopamine, which is one of the ways that exercise can in fact become kind of a positive addiction, or even in some cases a harmful addiction, depending on how much you do it. But it can make strenuous physical exercise actually become pleasurable. And this has been shown in both humans as well as lab animals that we get this opioid release. Now,
they have a whole bunch of happy little rats running on treadmills.
Exactly.
They're giggling after a while.
Smiles on their faces like little dolphins. Now, there's also the cannabinoid hypothesis, and this is that the brain not only releases its own forms of opioid chemicals, but it also releases cannabinoids.
Dude.
Now, when we think about cannabinoids, a lot of times we think about marijuana or, you know, even some of the synthetic cannabinoids that have been derived from marijuana, but those are exogenous forms of cannabinoids. And what we're talking about here are what are called endogenous forms of cannabinoids, or endocannabinoids. And those are things that your body produces itself. Yes, your body is capable of producing its own cannabinoids.
Sweet.
And those those act on the same receptors. So they would act on the same receptors that something like, you know, weed or an edible or some other form of cannabinoid would act on. And they do it during intense exercise. So you've got opioids and you've got cannabinoids that are being released during the runner's high. And so if you're having a difficult time achieving the runner's high, then there's a couple of thoughts that I have for you. First of all is you may not actually be running at a high enough intensity to cause the physical discomfort that would require your body to actually release these opioids or these endocannabinoids. That's one thing that you could think about. Another thing is that it's possible that you may have some kind of a receptor insensitivity to some of these opioids or cannabinoids. A lot of times if you've had addictions in the past, you do need greater amounts of a stimulant to be able to get those receptors to activate to the same extent. So if you I suspect that this is why you see sometimes people who were like ex-alcoholics, ex-drug addicts, they turn to something like ultra running or ultra marathoning or ultra cycling to kind of get that same high. But they got to go out there and do it for a really long time, a lot of times at higher pain thresholds in order to get that fix, in order to get that high. So I don't know if Celia used to be, you know,
she
an
might
addict
have been a party
or,
girl.
Yeah, or a big party or something like that. But that may influence this as well. Now, the interesting thing is that you can get phytocannabinoids – exogenous phytocannabinoids without necessarily living in Washington or Colorado and get some of this same exposure without, for example, smoking weed.
So the pipe.
Exactly. The interesting thing here is that when you were first born, you got exposed to a bunch of cannabinoids because breast milk is rife with the stuff. So it's really, really interesting. But children, when they're babies, if they were fed with human breast milk, that's actually a pretty abundant source of endocannabinoids. Now, one of the reasons that it's hypothesized that breast milk contains those is that there's some kind of a neuromodulation that teaches kids how to become almost like not addicted, but extremely attracted to the suckling process. And that if there weren't those cannabinoids in breast milk, that newborn children wouldn't know how to eat or have a desire to eat, and that could result in malnourishment or death. And it is very, very similar physiologically to the reason that adult individuals who smoke pot get the munchies, because those doses of cannabinoids trigger hunger and could potentially promote growth and development in children because they're going to end up eating more. And there's a very interesting study in the European Journal of Pharmacology about this cannabinoid receptor system in babies and the activation of milk sucking specifically that can cause. This is also interesting because I was talking yesterday for a series of online videos that I'm in the process of creating for one of these. It's like an online video conference I'm producing this winter with 30 different experts who speak in different areas about nutrition and fitness and things. And a guy I interviewed yesterday for this was John Kiefer, who's actually on the panel with me for a couple of panels down at Paleo FX. And we were talking about when it's okay to cheat and what you can cheat on when you cheat on a meal. And he brought up ice cream. And he pointed out to me that ice cream is actually a source of, because it is a mammalian-based milk product, it's a source of endocannabinoids. And it's one of the reasons that it's so easy to overeat ice cream, because it has these cannabinoids in it. So that's one thing that Celia could think about is – eating some ice cream. It's probably going to be easier to find ice cream than breast milk anyways. So you could go after ice cream, or find a pregnant friend and go after breast milk, whatever's easiest for you or most comfortable for you. And you could use that as a source of cannabinoids. Now, I'm going to link to a fascinating paper that appeared in the Journal of Pharmacology called Phytocannabinoids Beyond the Cannabis Plant. And this goes into a ton of additional sources of these endogenous cannabinoids. And it turns out that there are a variety of plant derivatives that actually contain this. Tea, for example, is one thing. Other plant natural products that contain smaller amounts of these cannabinoids that might result in a similar high. One is echinacea, which is great for the immune system, but apparently echinacea also has relatively high amounts of these cannabinoids. There's a bunch of others in there. I'll link to the study. It's a little bit nerdy, the study. It goes into like the Latin name of a lot of these plants and stuff, but it's kind of interesting, of course, or you could just move to Washington or Colorado. And ultimately, what I would say is when it comes to creating the runner's high, you might need to run a little bit harder. You might want to include some endogenous cannabinoids in your diet if you really want to create the runner's high. And then the other thing to think about is, in some cases, neurotransmitter imbalances can exist. And probably one of the best ways to find out whether or not you have neurotransmitter imbalances is there is a panel you can get called a neuroendocrine panel. And that's offered by a company called Direct Labs. And you can actually order that from Direct Labs, and it will help you to determine any neurotransmitter like dopamine, gamma-aminobutyric acid, serotonin type of deficits that you might have. So it's called a neuroendocrine panel, and that's over at Direct Labs that you could do something like that. I don't think you have to give 16 vials of blood, so don't worry.
Yeah, I think we just inadvertently explained the popularity of the post-run brunch.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody gets munchies from their runner's high, and then they want to go have brunch.
Yum, yum.
Totally makes sense.
Hi, Ben and Brock. This is Jim from Detroit. You're my first podcast I ever listened to and still my favorite. I've downloaded a ton of old ones, most of your podcasts, and I've never heard anything about megadose of B12. I am training for an Ironman, and I am working out between 10 and maybe even 18 hours a week. And as part of my long gym workouts, I generally use a product called Zip Fizz, which is kind of like a no-sugar energy drink that has a mega dose of B12, which is, it says on the label, it's a 41,000% dose of our daily recommended need of that drug. So is this beneficial to me? I mean, the drink tastes good, and I feel like I get more energy, but I don't know if that's just a placebo effect. So thanks a lot, and I will be a listener for life. Thanks. Bye.
Have you ever heard of Zip Fizz?
Zip Fizz, yeah. I've actually I used to use Zip Fizz on the airplane. You know, the issue with it, though, is I think I remember Zip Fizz. One of the reasons I quit using it was it's got a lot of has a ton of, like, artificial ascorbic acid in it, but then also a bunch of, artificial sweetener. I think it's, like, sucralose or acetylsulfamide potassium, or sure as heck doesn't have Zevia soda in it. Yeah.
It makes me think of those Pop Rocks.
Mm, yeah, exactly. But no, it's like an effervescent, like a powder that you put into the water. Yeah, and it does have vitamin B12 megadoses in it. And the deal
41,000% of your recommended daily amount.
Exactly. Now, vitamin B12 is a pretty important vitamin. It's actually in high doses may actually act as a neurotropic, and this is something this was actually for another
poisoning you.
No, it actually, in a full vitamin B complex, has some pretty cool neurotropic effects when you're able to megadose with it. In terms of, for the people who don't know what a neurotropic is, it basically can enhance mental performance. But vitamin B12 specifically is necessary for processing things like carbs and proteins and fats to help make blood cells. It's required for the maintenance of your nerve sheaths, and it's also a coenzyme that's used in the synthesis and repair of DNA. And this is why you not only see higher amounts of vitamin B12 turnover in athletes, but you also see athletes respond pretty well to B12 as an actual supplement. Now, there are a couple of things that you should know about B12, though. First of all, it can't be absorbed or used by the body unless it's combined with a specific type of mucoprotein that's made in your stomach. That's called intrinsic factor. And then once the B12 is bound to the intrinsic factor, it's able to pass into the small intestine to be absorbed and used by the body. And this is one of the reasons why you see, for example, folks who use a vitamin B12 orally, like a pill or a capsule or something like that, you tend not to see a very good effect from just like a basic oral form of vitamin B12, because that form of vitamin B12 is not very well combined with that mucoprotein in the stomach.
And is that why your pee changes color so drastically?
There's not much absorption that occurs.
So it's all just coming out in your urine?
Now, there are two ways that you can get B12 in adequate form if you were to want to do something like megadose with B12. And I'll talk in a second about whether or not it even, recommend that or where you need to be careful. But sublingual. So you can take a B12 capsule, you can take a B12 powder. I actually use a full vitamin B complex myself a few days a week. It's that Life Shot stuff. That has about 5,000 to 6,000% of the daily value of B12 in it. I like it just because it also has the other B12 complex in it. It's got quercetin and resveratrol and some other wild plant extracts in it. And
I only tried that stuff once, and I actually felt it working.
Yeah,
I actually felt kind of warm and flush and energetic. Yeah.
I don't use it every day. I use it a few days of the week, usually on the days where I go swimming, because it has some pretty good effects against the cell membrane damaging effects of chlorine.
Yeah.
But I dump it in my mouth and I hold it in my mouth for about 60 to 90 seconds, so I get sublingual absorption. which is a really good. So if you can get a sublingual, like a vitamin B12 spray, for example, or a powder you can put in your mouth, you're going to get far better absorptibility. And if you really want to take things to the next level, you would actually do like a vitamin B12 injection. That's the whole idea behind these things called Myers cocktails, is they bypass that whole issue with digestion and absorption of vitamin B12, and you just basically mainline straight into your bloodstream. And
they call that the banana bag when you're in the hospital.
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly. Yeah, I mean, one of my athletes this week was sick and had a pretty important business issue he had to deal with, and I actually got him into his local naturopath for a couple of Myers cocktails this week with high-dose vitamin C to get his immune system straightened up and to help him to feel better. And you know, in some cases, when you really want to get a mega dose of a lot of these water-soluble vitamins that are, in fact, okay in these higher amounts, that's another way to do it, is to actually, you know, go to a local naturopathic physician or natural medical clinic that will do high-dose IVs and get something like a Myers cocktail. Anyways, though, as far as vitamin B12 toxicity goes and whether or not you're actually putting yourself at risk when you do it, there are a few things to think about. When you're looking at something called Leber's disease, L-E-B-E-R disease, that is where vitamin B12 megadoses would be contraindicated. Now, you probably know if you've got Leber's disease, but it can cause damage to your optic nerve, and that can cause some issues. You may find that you get numbness or tingling in your arms or your hands or your face, and that would be an indication that you are taking in excess amounts of vitamin B12, and that would be another situation where I would definitely back off. I personally have not seen any studies that have shown much benefit in exceeding about 5,000% of the daily value. And what did Jim say? He's at about 40-something percent of the RDA. So I think ZipFizz may have actually gone overboard as far as that's concerned. Yeah, exactly. Now, the interesting thing about vitamin B12, though, is that this and a lot of the other vitamins, especially if you're not beating up your body on a daily basis, if it's not a heavy exercise day for you, if you have a healthy gut flora, your own gut flora makes just about all the vitamins that you need. And much of the vitamin B12 specifically in your body is produced by your gut flora, by the good bacteria in your stomach. So if you are eating a wide variety of fermented foods, paying attention to your gut flora and taking care of your small intestine, you shouldn't need to take that much vitamin B12, since the bacteria in your body are producing the B12. And that's the most absorbable form that you could get. You know, it's going to be bound very, very readily to intrinsic factor. It's going to be absorbed and utilized very, very well. And so, you know, that's why I don't megadose with vitamin B12 complex unless I know I'm exposing my body to some pretty serious stress, you know, such as, you know, soaking myself in chlorine for 30 minutes while I'm swimming or something like that. So ultimately, my take on B12 is use B12, you know, megadosing, for example, on days where you're really putting your body through the wringer. If you really seriously need a huge boost of water-soluble vitamins, for example, like vitamin C and vitamin B12 for a boost to the immune system, then you're probably going to need to look up something like an intravenous injection. And then for the most part, most days, just eat a wide variety of fermented foods and take care of your gut. And you shouldn't need to dose with an excess of vitamins anyways, because your body is going to make most of what it needs from, you know, fat-soluble vitamins like vitamin K to water-soluble vitamins like vitamin B12. So that's the deal with vitamin B. Taking that much is not going to hurt you necessarily. And I should mention one other thing. There was one study that people often talk about that say that excess vitamin B12 may cause prostate cancer. The thing with that particular study, and it was one that appeared in the International Journal of Cancer, and it was entitled Plasma Folate, Vitamin B12, Homocysteine, and Prostate Cancer Risk. What they found in that study was that people who got prostate cancer did have higher blood levels of vitamin B12, but weren't necessarily supplementing with mega doses of vitamin B12. They just had more in their bloodstream. And I suspect it's because of some type of a defense mechanism mounted by the body that upregulated vitamin B12 availability, and not the fact that these folks who got prostate cancer were mega dosing with vitamin B12. So always be careful and look at the actual source of information.
The good old correlation versus causation.
Exactly. Thing. So the prostate cancer B12 mix is not valid. So that's the skinny on B12.
Hello, Ben and Brock. Todd calling from San Diego. I made a commitment to myself to try and be in better shape at 50 than I am now at 46. I did the same thing when I was 30, said I'd be in better shape at 35, 40 at 35, you get the picture. But I'm trying now, instead of making it so subjective and leaving it to my opinion, come up with, I don't know what the number is, 6, 8, 10, 12 different set of metrics that I can test myself every 2 years to make sure I'm doing that, keeping in mind that as I get older, obviously I'm not going to be able to run a mile as quickly or lift as much or whatever it is, but I want to come up with a set of criteria that I can use every 2 years or so to kind of measure where I am to see if I'm actually improving or not. And so then I can adjust accordingly. Thanks.
Todd, I like the cut of your jib. This is a good idea.
I keep talking. I gotta finish my drink of soda there.
Guzzle that.
That's right.
Guzzle that sucker.
Tracking fitness. You know, this is actually something that I talked about. I don't know if you remember, Brock, at the Superhuman Conference, I talked a little bit about strength standards ways, basically things that you should be able to do, whether you're a man or a woman, expectations you should have of yourself if you want to have the necessary amount of strength for performance, for hormone production, for lean body mass, and for longevity. And these are strength standards that were designed by Dan John, who's been on this podcast before. I'll put a link in the show notes on this episode over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/279, where you can go listen to my Mass Made Simple podcast with Dan John, where we talk a little bit about this stuff. But the first thing I would have are strength parameters. In my opinion, when it comes to longevity and fitness, strength parameters are gonna trump VO2 max, blood lactate, some of these other parameters I'll tell you about here in a second. I'm going to give you the exact parameters for men and for women. Cool. So for men, body weight bench press. Okay, you should be able to bench press your body weight. So if you weigh 175 pounds, you should be able to bench press 175 pounds.
Just a single rep?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, gotcha. I mean, we're not talking about huge parameters here. Now, what Dan John is, he has the expected, like what you should be able to do, and also the game changer, what you should be able to do if you want to, if you're serious and you want to be like on the elite end. So body weight bench press, you should be able to do a rep of. Body weight bench press for 15 reps would be your game changer. Hmm. Okay. Pull-ups, should be able to do 5 pull-ups, body weight. Game changer would be 15 pull-ups. And this is, again, for guys. For
is that overhand or underhand?
That's a pull up, a chin up is underhand, pull up is overhand.
Gotcha.
Yep. So deadlift, you should be able to do 150% of your body weight. So take 1.5, multiply that by your body weight, you should be able to lift that off the ground. Kind of the more elite level game changer, you should be able to do double your body weight. It's not 1.5 times your body weight, but 2 times your body weight, lifting that off the ground. For the squat, again, for guys, you should be able to squat your own body weight, okay, once. Now, game changer would be you can squat your own body weight 15 times. Next would be a loaded carrier, what's called a farmer's walk. So for a farmer's walk, you should be able to walk with half of your total body weight in each hand. So if you weigh 180 pounds, you should be able to take a 90-pound dumbbell in each hand, and you need to be able to walk 20 feet with that, okay? Hmm. And if you want to perform more the more elite level, you should be able to actually walk 20 feet holding your body weight in each hand. So if you weigh 175 pounds, you should be able to literally take 175 pounds in each hand and be able to move it 20 feet. And then finally, from a mobility standpoint, you should be able to do 1 get-up, which means getting up from a lying position on the ground all the way up to standing with your arm held over your head, and you should be able to do that on both your left side and on your right side while holding a cup of water over your head and not spilling the water. Okay. So I like those strength standards. For women, they're pretty similar, except for women, for the pull-ups, it would be 3 instead of 5. And for the squat, it would actually be, and I have no clue why he has this changed up for women for the squat, but he has, rather than it being your body weight that you'd be able to squat, you'd be able to squat 135 pounds for 5 reps. That seems kind of random to me. It seems easier to just remember and be able to do your body weight. But for some reason, maybe it's because some women are extremely light and squatting, you know, whatever, 100 pounds is easy for them.
Maybe.
So anyways, those are strength standards. And I really like those. And I'll link over to the podcast we do with Dan John where we get into those an even more detailed level. And I would say that if you were to do a test, you know, every year to be able to see if you're able to do that, that's a pretty good standard.
Have you seen, I was just going to say, there's this, Mark's Daily Apple did a great roundup of all the modern fitness standards. He's got like the Utah police officer standards, the Marine Corps SEALs,
oh, really? The
firefighters, football and basketball draft standards. It's kind of cool. We should put it in the show notes.
Yeah, link to that in the show notes. Love Mark Sisson stuff. So that's great.
Yeah, I know Mark's got his own measurements that he calls the primal fitness standards or something like that as well.
Cool. Let's throw them in
there.
I think
they're quite similar to Dan John's. I can't find them at the moment, but I'll find them and throw them in the show notes.
Cool. So we'll put those in the show notes. Another few things I would look into, blood lactate testing and VO2 max testing. Those are both metabolic tests that if you are kind of looking for endurance, if you're a triathlete, marathoner, cyclist, swimmer, that type of thing, those are good parameters to measure. VO2 max is maximum oxygen utilization. Blood lactate is the peak amount of lactic acid that you produce at specific intensities. And I will put a link to an article that I wrote for Triathlete Magazine that delves into how to interpret those values and the best way to get that test. Or you could just Google, you know, the name of your city plus metabolic testing, and those are pretty good tests. So those would be, again, just about once a year that you would need to do something like that. I have some athletes who will do it up to 4 times a year to actually change their intensity as they go throughout the training year. But blood lactate and VO2 max testing, especially if endurance is your bent, would be another couple to look into. Cool. Daily, 2 things I test: heart rate variability. So when I wake up in the morning, I do a heart rate variability test using my heart rate monitor and the Sweetbeat phone app, and then pulse oximetry, which is just a fingertip-based measurement of my blood oxygenation. I look for that to be above 97%, ideally, and it's just a basic pulse oximeter test. And those are 2 things you can keep on your bedside that are super easy to test on a daily basis.
Especially if you're already wearing your health patch.
Exactly. If you have one of these,
To sit up and try and strap on your heart rate monitor.
Yeah. For those who don't know what a health patch is, it's this new device that you can put on that will transmit to your phone your heart rate variability signal. It's a very low frequency signal. It's not like having a cell phone next to your body all the time. You can actually have your cell phone in airplane mode with just the Bluetooth signal turned on, and you'll be able to communicate your heart rate variability to your phone really at any time during the day if you wanted to, while you're exercising, whatever. I personally am more of kind of like the just do it for 5 minutes in the morning kind of guy, but that's just me, just because I like to be disconnected from technology as much as I can. Now, the next thing, or the last thing I would mention would be, there's a company called RestWise. Hmm. Now, RestWise will allow you each day to go in and log things like your mood, your sleep, your stress, your soreness. They even have an option in there to put in that pulse oximetry value that I talked about, and then it will kick out a score for you for each day. And again, this would be a daily, more than like an every couple of years type of test, but that's another good way to keep track of daily metrics if you're really kind of a self-quant person and you want to just have this running algorithm of exactly how you're doing. You want to be able to predict injury, stress, overtraining. You want to see when those numbers dip so that potentially you could step back on your training, allow your nervous system and your muscle fibers to recover, and then jump back in. But that would be another one to look into as well. And by the way, a lot of this stuff is fresh on my mind because We're producing the audiobook right now for Beyond Training, and I just got done recording the chapter on how to identify, you know, whether you're overtrained or under-recovered, and some of these things I talk about in that chapter. So I spent about an hour in front of the microphone yesterday reading that chapter. So, it's interesting stuff, but those are some of the things I would recommend.
Hi, Ben and Brock. This is Emily calling to you from Sweden. I have a question regarding babies that are entering into the world of solid foods. What would you and Jessa introduce first, and in what order would you do it? And do you think it's important for babies to be subjected to gluten at all to help them tolerate it further on? I would really appreciate your input. Thank you.
You know, not having any children whatsoever of my own, I'm totally, you know, going to put my headphones down and just leave the room for a while because I have nothing to say about this.
You were never even a baby, were you?
No.
You were just, experience whatsoever.
I was grown
whatsoever.
In a test tube, basically.
Yep, exactly. You were born.
I don't even have a belly button, actually.
I was going to say, you don't have a belly button, do you?
Yeah.
No. Okay. Well, you know, the conventional wisdom behind baby food is that, you know, you start with your rice cereal and then you go into your infant oatmeal and then maybe you have some processed fruits or some Gerber baby food, you know, some pureed veggies.
That's
like
a lot of carbs.
Squash or sweet potato, and then you move into pudding and, you know, and eventually,
cake.
Of course, like Cheerios and Rice Krispies and
tablespoons,
you know, yogurt.
Full of sugar.
Exactly, which is really what that is. And it's one of the things I've talked about before on this show. And it's that we take our babies and we start them off with breast milk, you know, their fatty acids and their ketones and their now that we know, cannabinoids. Mm-hmm. And then we gradually rip them away from that, rip them out of being in that fat-adapted state, and we shift them into a reliance upon sugar and carbohydrates. And I think that's just one of the worst things you can do for a child's metabolism. When you're looking at a better scenario, a more natural scenario, it's not that I am against pureed, blended foods, things of that nature, but I think that we need to choose more nutrient-dense foods. And these are some of the things that we did with our kids. So we would get a lot of organic vegetables primarily. We'd go pretty easy on the fruits, even though we did dark berries to some extent. But pureed beets, pureed carrots, pureed spinach, sweet potatoes to a limited extent, turnips, a little bit of berries, things of that nature. And what Jessa would do is she would blend all of those, she would freeze them, and then have those available as basically like, you know, easy to digest sources for the kids.
Little lollipops?
When they were under 6 months old.
Popsicles?
Yeah, you know, well, she'd take them out and thaw them, basically.
Spinach popsicles.
Yeah, yeah. And what you can do is you want to add specifically fatty acids to that. Now, a lot of those vegetables have some natural amounts of amino acids in them. They're good and get some amino acids and some proteins from breast milk too. But you want to be sure you add fats. A couple of the good ways I like to add fats, one would be avocados. Those are easy to blend in and add to those type of foods. Another one would be some type of nutrient-dense organ source. I'm a fan of cod liver oil for something like that. And there are companies like Peter Gillum's Natural Vitality or Omega Squirrel or Green Pastures that make these cod liver oils or these rich fatty acid sources that are palatable for kids that can easily be added to these pureed mixes. And they can actually give the kids some of these fatty acids that are necessary. Another thing that can work is to take eggs and to cook egg yolks specifically to offer a lot of really good essential cholesterol to kids. And those are something else that can mix pretty well with fruits. So you've got some of your staples as being avocados, egg yolks, cod liver oil, and then you've got your pureed beets, pureed carrots, pureed spinach, some of your other pureed dark leafy greens, sweet potatoes, turnips, and then some really nice dark, like antioxidant-rich berries. So nice. Those are some of the things that I would definitely include, you know, as you're leading up to that 6 month period, where then you're eventually just going to begin to move them towards solid food that you are eating. And that's essentially what we did for about the first 6 months, you know, along with breastfeeding. And I forget up to what age Jessa did breastfeeding. I think it was right around a year or so that we were at the breastfeeding stage. But
really, that seems short.
I'm pretty sure that was what she took them to, even though, like, if we could go back and do it again, we'd probably go longer than that, just based off of some of the benefits I've seen of breastfeeding and also child attachment to parents at, you know, going into later ages. But then
is that why your kids are already moving out of the house?
Yeah, exactly. They're gone. Guys. We screwed up. We didn't breastfeed for long enough. We're out of here. Anyways, though, the thing we did then was we would just basically cut into small pieces and give them the same foods that we were eating, you know, sardines, avocados, you know, chicken, just basically anything that we ate. We did a lot of pastured raw dairy, organic meats, you know, all that stuff, and would just cut it into small pieces and have that there for the kids too. And you can run meat through a food mill. If you have a food mill and you want to get even extra iron and protein, you can actually do meat that way too. I mean, technically you could blend meat if you wanted to, but I don't know. So
doesn't sound good.
Another thing that Emily asked about, though, was gluten and whether there was any point into introducing kids to gluten at all in an early stage so they could tolerate it later.
Yeah.
There is some interesting research that has actually looked into this. What they've found is that when children are given gluten at an earlier age, specifically prior to 4 months old, they actually show a greater oral tolerance to gluten antigens than if they were given gluten after 6 months old.
Hmm.
Now, general recommendations are that gluten not be given, or what general recommendations used to be actually, was that gluten not be given until a child was 6 months old or older. And now that's changed to about 4 months. But it's interesting that it actually does indicate there may be this window of opportunity for developing some tolerance to gluten, and there may actually be some benefit to including some amount of gluten sources in a child's diet somewhere between the 4 to 6 month old stage. Now, some people's jaws may be dropping, you know, and I'm not necessarily...
Yeah, I think I just heard Dave Asprey jump off a roof.
I'm not advocating you feed Wonder Bread to your child. Remember that the main issue with wheat and with a lot of our modern grains is that they've been bred for high yield crops. And this concentrates the amount of wheat germagglutinin that's in that grain. Now, wheat germagglutinin has these disulfide bonds in it that are very, very similar to the type of bonds that are in human hair. Makes it very flexible and durable, but it also makes the wheat germagglutinin, which is essentially a lectin, extremely resistant to digestion and more capable of causing some pretty serious gut distress, leaky gut, small intestine inflammation, things of that nature. And you're going to find this in a lot of modern forms of wheat, the same type of wheat that is used to make things like, you know, Cheerios and a lot of these wheat cereals and other gluten-containing grains that are popular children's items, you know, probably even Pop-Tarts, although I'm not sure that Pop-Tarts actually have any real thing in them, including food? Wheat, period. Yeah. I think it's just some type of coloring and then a lot of chemicals.
Speaking of fairy dust.
Yeah. So good in a toaster, though. Anyways, though, and I used to do everything with Pop-Tarts. I used to do ketchup with my Pop-Tarts.
Oh.
I was a total Pop-Tarts pizza hamburger kid. Right. Anyways, though, this doesn't mean that other sources of gluten, let's say oatmeal, for example, is going to have a little bit of gluten in it, or like a nice soaked and sprouted sourdough bread. That's going to be really easy for a kid to chew if, you know, you're not giving that to them with the crust. Things of that nature may actually be gluten sources that aren't going to be all that bad for a kid to get exposed to. It would be the modern sources of modified grains that you'd want to be careful with. primarily in the case of children, traditional breakfast cereals would be a biggie, and traditional breads would be a biggie. Those would be two gluten sources that if you are going to expose your child to gluten at that 4 to 6 month old stage, I would not be exposing them to. So I would be really careful with that. But this is a consideration for adults too, because, for example, I'm going to go do the Seal Fit training camp in August, and that's kind of like the equivalent of Hell Week for civilians. And from what I understand, you know, you get some meal replacements there, you get some pizza, you get some, you know, some things that are not necessarily primal foods or, you know, non-gluten containing foods. And you'll get folks who get into the military as well, who are going to get exposed to a lot of gluten. And that's a case where you may want to consider actually, you know, going into battle, both literally and figuratively here, with some type of gluten digesting enzyme. So there, mm-hmm. there are these enzymes called dipeptidyl peptidases. Those are digestive enzymes that you can actually take. Dipeptidyl peptidase.
That's delightful.
Should we take it, make it like Cartman from South Park?
Sure.
You guys, dipeptidyl peptidase, you guys, over here.
Anyway, so you take these DDP is another name for them, DDPs. So you can take these DDPs and they can help you to digest cereal grains, things that have higher levels of gluten in them. And typically you'll get these combined with things like amylases and enzymes that assist in the breakdown of carbohydrates. I like this stuff by Now Foods. So if you're going to get gluten exposure, they can work after you've had gluten and cereal grains. They can work before, but you would get these into your system at some point within about anywhere from 20 to 45 minutes before or after your exposure, and they can help out quite a bit. So
I was thinking it was something that you could kind of load with maybe like for like have them over the weekend and then you're like good for the next week.
Just like any enzyme, they need to be in your tummy at the time that you actually are wanting them to work on the compound that you're eating them with. So
bummer.
The closer to the meal, the better. But some type of DDP enzyme, I think, should be kind of something everybody has around as that just in case, you know, not necessarily to justify, you know, digging into a big bowl of pasta, but kind of, you know, in those situations where, you know, you've had a bunch of gluten, you know, you're going to get a tummy ache, you know, that type of thing. And you want some help digesting that equivalent of human hair that you just ate. So at some point, you know, Jess has done a lot of stuff over at the Ben Greenfield Fitness Inner Circle for babies and kids and baby foods and stuff like that. So you may want to check out bengreenfieldfitness.com/innercircle. And as an aside to that, I've also started logging my daily workouts over there. So folks who want to see what I'm doing for my workouts, get some ideas for exercises, workouts, stuff like that, all my Inner Circle members not only get access to cool snapshots of the foods I'm eating, but I'm also uploading my workouts now too. So that's all over.
That's different than it has been in the past when you were always training for triathlon.
Yeah.
You're doing some completely different kind of workouts these days.
Yeah, my workouts are kind of crazy and all over the place right now between Spartan and Seal Fit and all that jazz. But they're fun and they're a challenge if you want to go in and do what Ben is doing and eat what Ben eats. Then it's
and
all
say,
over
screw
there.
It, I'm heading for the forest instead of going to the gym.
I just talked about myself in the third person, which is really nerdy.
I didn't notice that. Yeah.
Hi, Ben and Brock. This is Alyssa from Connecticut. I'm a huge fan of your website, podcast. You guys are fantastic. I listen to you all the time. I have a question about a skin condition called keratosis pilaris. It's unsightly red bumps, also known as chicken skin, that I've had in my upper arms. Some people grow out of it, but I'm 26 and I don't think I'm going to grow out of it. I was wondering if you know anything about the etiology of this condition, if it's a dietary allergy, hormone imbalance, something like that, and if you have any recommendations, either food or creams, anything that could help get rid of it. I've tried a few things, but if anyone can help me out, I think it's you guys. So thank you very much and have a wonderful day.
You know, I was while I was getting these questions ready, my girlfriend was sitting in the back of the living room sort of vaguely paying attention. And when this question came up, she all of a sudden got really excited, ran over and started pointing at my leg because I actually have a blotch on my shin that she all of a sudden was like,
there's a cockroach on your leg or a spider or something.
Not quite that exciting, but she all of a sudden was like, that's what you've got. Because I've had this little blotch of exactly that, like a chicken skin sort of blotch on my shin for a good 3 months. And it's not itchy, doesn't do anything. It just looks weird.
Yeah. Keratosis pilaris, baby. KP.
Yeah. Me and Alyssa.
That's right.
So that's what we should do.
It's like these red or brown or flesh colored goose bumpy type of things. And a lot of people get them. Like about 50% of folks have at some point experienced this skin condition, this KP. So it happens when your skin makes excess keratin. And keratin is a protein that helps to provide structure to your skin. But if your body is unable to turn over old keratin or it makes excess keratin, then that can clog pores, it can trap hair inside follicles, and it can cause this discoloration. So there's a few things that you can do. The first, and this goes for just about any skin condition out there, from eczema to acne to keratosis, is you need to eliminate immune system triggers from your diet and heal your digestion. So the reason that that's so important is that anytime you have immune system sensitivities, you are going to have that gut-skin axis reaction. So from a digestive standpoint, if you suffer from skin conditions, allergies, weakened immune system, and since many neurotransmitters are made in your stomach or your gut, psychological imbalances, you know, cravings, things of that nature, it's very likely linked to a digestive weakness or some kind of a gut flora imbalance. And even if you may not have always been that way, you can go through a period of poor diet, a period of high stress, or a course of antibiotics, and all of a sudden be dealing with issues that you've never had to deal with before. Everything from depression to acne to skin conditions, et cetera. It's one of the reasons why going through high amounts of stress can all of a sudden cause you to break out. So healing your gut is really, really important. I would recommend that you look into something like the paleo autoimmune diet is really, really good. That's a four up to, I mean, you could follow the diet for 12 weeks. You could follow it for a year if you wanted to, but I recommend people try it for at least 4 weeks to just eliminate all potential immune system triggers such as soy, wheat, commercial dairy, things of that nature. And see how the skin responds. Now, if you want to take that to the next level, there's a really excellent book that I actually read a couple of months ago, and it is called The Hidden Plague. It was written for folks who suffer from a more serious disorder of the skin called hidradenitis suppurativa. And that one is a lot more serious than this keratosis issue, and results in boils and scars and all sorts of nasty things, you know, cysts and ingrown hairs and some pretty serious acne. But that is from an autoimmune standpoint and kind of like a getting rid of issues that can cause immune system bounce back on the skin specifically. One of the best books I've read as far as that goes. I actually gave it to my sister because both her husband and her son, my nephew, deal with some skin issues. And so I thought it would help them out quite a bit. And the reason for that is it really is one of the best books that I've read on autoimmune. And I met Tara down at the Paleo FX conference, really nice person, and it's an excellently written book. So I would recommend you check out that book, The Hidden Plague. I, of course, also over the years that I've assisted people with healing their guts, have developed a gut-fixing pack, and that is colostrum, probiotics, oil of oregano, digestive enzymes, and then a really nourishing and non-irritating cleansing formula. And that's over at Pacific Elite Fitness, and it is just called the Gut Healing Pack or the Gut Fixing Pack. And I'll link to that for you as well in the show notes, because that can help out from the gut standpoint as well. So I would definitely pay attention to immunity in the gut before you start slathering stuff on your skin or doing anything of that nature. Now, another couple of things to look into, and I will tell you something you can put on your skin too here in a second, but one thing is vitamin C. Now, vitamin C is really important for collagen formation. It helps to maintain the integrity of your skin tissue. It counteracts free radicals. If you have a scar or a cut or something, it's kind of interesting. If you start taking high-dose vitamin C, you'll notice that it heals faster. And it can also reduce redness. It can reduce inflammation. Really, really good to take. If you're getting surgery, if you've had like a scar or an injury that threatens to create a scar or this KP, vitamin C is something I recommend. Now, you can get some vitamin C from, fruit, like an apple is going to give you 15 milligrams of vitamin C. But I keep this stuff made by a company called American Nutraceuticals around. And one tiny little spoonful of that is 5,000 milligrams of vitamin C.
Boom.
And I like to have it around because it has so many uses. So I can use it to bump up my immune system. I can use it when I've got a little bit of adrenal fatigue because a lot of vitamin C is used when you're under adrenal stress. I can use it when I've been cut and I need something to heal quickly or I don't want to form a scar. And another little trick you can use is if you take some of this vitamin C, about a teaspoon of it or about 5,000 milligrams, and you mix it with some of that natural calm magnesium in a glass of warm water. If you are ever constipated or you want to, I'll use this for example. Like, I don't like to have to go to the bathroom when I fly. So if I've got, like, let's say a 7 a.m. flight to go somewhere, I'll get up, 5:30 or whatever, whenever I need to go to the airport, I'll get up and I'll drink a warm glass of water with this vitamin C and magnesium mixed in. And within about 15 minutes, it initiates a bowel movement, and then you're good to go for a day of travel without having to worry about going to the bathroom. So it's good for that too. So all cleaned out in a healthy way. So so there's that too. Not only can
just
you
before get we leave out, the vitamin C, would you use it for something like a strain or a sprain? Like if you pulled a muscle or something, would that?
Yep, exactly. Any injury, anything like that. Vitamin C
tissue
is,
sort of stuff.
Yeah, anything that needs a step up for collagen formation, I'm a fan of. So I have that stuff around. It's not cheap. It's about $35 for a little canister of it. But I mean, it's not something you'd use every day.
Yeah.
But it is something you could use in a case like this. So cheap ass ascorbic acid is not something I would get. This
not
stuff
the
is
emergency
is yeah
tablets.
No, this is chelated, highly absorbable stuff that was recommended to me by a physician who uses it in his natural medical practice. So it's called American Nutraceuticals. You can get it off Amazon. We'll link to it in the show notes. Another thing would be liver. Or some type of a fish liver oil because of the vitamin A content. So without adequate vitamin A, skin cells will start to excrete an excess of keratin, which can create these dry, rough, scaly bumps. And yeah, you can get vitamin A from foods like carrots and spinach and sweet potatoes, but the carotene that are in those plant foods are not going to get converted into adequate vitamin A. It's just there's not much conversion that takes place. It's kind of like trying to get all your omega-3 fatty acids from flaxseed, for example. It's just it's very inferior to something like wild-caught fish. So eating liver once a week or so would be the best way to do this. If you just can't eat liver, you're a picky eater, you don't like liver, you don't want to go out of your way to eat it, then the next
best thing.
There are
people who don't like liver.
Believe it or not. I know, it's weird. It's really weird. Fish liver oil. So like I take when I'm not eating fish or eating liver, I will use the Super Essentials fish oil, and I just take four of those capsules, and it's got fish liver oil, astaxanthin, vitamin E, just like a lot of like a fat soluble cocktail in it. And that stuff would be good. You could use a cod liver oil. Of course, you could eat liver, like I mentioned. But those are going to be some of your best sources of vitamin A. So I would definitely go out of your way to get vitamin A into your system. And on a similar note, pantothenic acid cream, which is going to be a vitamin A-rich cream, is going to help out quite a bit as well. And this would be a cream that you can literally just put on your skin, and it's well, it's not, pantothenic acid is technically vitamin B5, but a lot of these lotions that are pantothenic acid based lotions, they're really vitamin A with some added pantothenic acid. Interestingly though, one of the better, more natural ways, if you want to avoid a lot of the things that wind up in these personal care products and lotions, if you want to get something that's got pantothenic acid and vitamin A in it and is completely natural, would be avocado oil. You can just get 100% pure, undiluted, cold pressed, unrefined, virgin avocado oil that's got vitamin A.
So the stuff you'd cook with.
Yep, it's got vitamin A, it's got your pantothenic acid, it's got all the things that are going to be effective against skin issues, from eczema to acne to keratosis to scars. And you just take avocado oil and you put it on the area that you want to treat. And that stuff can work really, really well. You should have avocado oil around anyways for high heat cooking, because it's really heat stable. But you can also use it for the skin.
Hey, Ben and Brock, this is Hank. My question revolves around getting really, really pure sources of creatine that are pretty safe. There's a disease called Huntington's disease that runs in my family, and some family members have unfortunately inherited the gene that causes Huntington's disease. And while there's no medical treatment for that in any way, there was a study that's results are going to be published this month, where they were giving participants 15 to 30 grams of creatine, and they were seeing some very positive effects in terms of slowing the degradation. Unfortunately, that level of creatine would be like eating a bottle a day from the types of creatine sources you get at the health food store. So what I'm looking for are reputable, good, safe, very concentrated sources of creatine that I could direct my family members to. And then also, if there's any thing that we should be telling their general practitioners in terms of things to watch out for taking those that high dosage of creatine. Thank you.
It's an interesting study, although 15 to 30 grams of creatine?
Yeah.
That's a lot.
It's a lot of creatine. So from a sports performance. Habit. Yeah. Well, actually, you know, creatine's not super expensive, but from a sports performance standpoint, creatine is the most studied supplement out there, period.
Yeah.
Creatine 101 is this molecule that can rapidly produce energy. So creatine phosphate rapidly produces ATP. And that supports cellular function, but it also has some cool neuroprotective properties as well. And it's a known neurotropic, similar to, like, you know, I talked earlier about a vitamin B12 complex, and getting adequate vitamin B12 can have neuroprotective properties and a neurotropic mental performance enhancing effect.
You know where I just read about that?
So can creatine. The Biohacks blog?
No. Oh. A chapter in Beyond Training.
Oh, yeah. I do talk about that in Beyond Training.
My brain section.
The 21 hacks to fix your brain section. Yeah. So there you go.
Beyond Training book.
We're selling this book left and right.
So creatine, 5 grams a day, no loading period. You're getting what you need. The stuff that I use, and I cycle on this, I take it about 6 months out of the year. Just because I like to cycle some of the supplements that I take, not based on research, but just based on the fact that I think it's smart to not be taking something all the time. But
you're doing 6 months on, 6 months off?
I generally have 6 months out of the year, and it's usually the spring and the summer for me, where I'm extremely active, and I go 5 grams of creatine a day. I use this stuff from Millennium Sports. It's called Creo2, and it's an enteric-coated creatine tablet. It's about 5 grams or so in a serving, but they throw some things in there like cordyceps and rhodiola, Eleuthero, you know, some of these things that assist with absorption. It's chelated.
Isn't that a bunch of the same stuff that's in the TNG?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm kind of getting a lot of adaptogens.
Mega dosing.
So enteric coating, though, allows it to bypass destruction in the intestine and kind of allows it to remain stable as it passes through the acidic environment in the stomach. So
interesting.
Pretty absorbable form of creatine. But if you were doing like 15 to 30 grams a day, this stuff would get expensive. I would, in that case, would just go with a basic plain Jane creatine monohydrate, assuming it is made in a cGMP facility. So certified, good manufacturing practices facility, tested for verification, guaranteed purity. Generally you want to get something that's like, you know, factory sealed, which is going to be like kind of a zip pouch type of deal. That's the same way I get, some of the smart drugs like aniracetam and piracetam and stuff like that. But creatine, in that form, there's a company called Bulk Supplements. You should be able to find them on Amazon. We'll find a link and put it in the show notes for you. But just a basic, pure, what's called a micronized creatine monohydrate powder, you can get that in a pretty big, like 1 kilogram portion for $15-$20. So that's what I would go with. As far as actual toxicity, there is a lot of mythage out there that creatine is somehow bad for your kidneys. And there was one case study where a man who had one kidney that had some damage to that one kidney supplemented at creatine at 20 grams a day for 5 days and then did a maintenance period for 30 days. And despite still having a very high protein diet, still suffered no issues with his kidneys at all. Oh. So, there's no evidence out there to show that creatine, even in the presence of kidney dysfunction, is dangerous at those type of doses. However, there's also not any evidence from a performance standpoint to show that exceeding 5 grams a day is somehow going to help you. Hmm. Now, as far as treating Huntington's disease, I don't know. This isn't a medical podcast. I'm not qualified to give medical advice. I haven't seen any of this research that shows you can slow the progress of Huntington's by dosing with 15 to 30 grams of creatine. I can tell you that if I were going down this road, though, I would be sure to be doing a kidney panel pretty frequently. So blood urea, nitrogen, creatinine, basically looking at glomerular stress, looking at hydration, looking at electrolyte status, just to make sure that nothing was going on from a kidney standpoint. So I would just basically be sure to be getting a kidney panel if you're doing high dosing of creatine. So that incidentally was part of the 16 tubes of blood that I gave this morning, was to see how the old kidneys are holding up. So
nice.
Anyways, though, ultimately, creatine monohydrate powder is fine for high dosage. If you want to get something a little bit more fancy, go with an enteric coated form of creatine. No need to exceed 5 grams a day for most people. Possibly, even though I don't really know the answer for Hank, you know, if you're trying to control Huntington's disease, yeah, possibly, it may have some efficacy, but I would definitely be doing a kidney panel once every month or so, just to make sure, especially in the initial phases, that there's nothing interesting going on from that standpoint. So,
well, there you go.
And speaking of interesting things going on, iTunes has been rife with reviews, and I saw a review called Freak Out Your In-Laws on there.
Freak Out Your In-Laws.
Freak Out Your In-Laws.
That's my favorite game to play.
Let's hear what they have to say. Oh, and by the way, we're going to read this review, but if you hear your review get read, then we are going to delve into the Ben Greenfield swag bag and send you a BPA-free water bottle branded with BenGreenfieldFitness.com. We are going to send you a cool tech t-shirt. Comfy tech t-shirt, not those nasty cotton tents, but a real cool t-shirt that actually makes you look good. And then a beanie, BenGreenfieldFitness.com stylish, fashionable beanie. So if you leave a review on iTunes and you hear us read your review on the show, just email Ben@BenGreenfieldFitness.com. We'll send you your Ben Greenfield Fitness gear package. Alternatively, or at the same time, you could also just promote the show out of the goodness of your heart by going and buying one of those gear packages at BenGreenfieldFitness.com/gear. So that being said, what do they have to say, Brock?
All right. This one's from Twain5265. And Twain5265 says, while the information provided by Ben and Brock is expansive and the benefits immeasurable, I find that the most satisfying of the myriad advantages to regularly listening to the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast is the ability to freak out my in-laws.
Wow.
From a kitchen stocked with head cheese and sardines to bathrooms equipped with squatty potties to uncomfortably humping a foam roller. Nice. Your spouse's parents will continue to wonder what's wrong with you. Thanks to Ben and Brock for everything.
Why is he living with his in-laws? She? I don't know. If
Twain is a man or a woman.
I guess having a kitchen stocked with head cheese and sardines and a bathroom equipped with squatty potties is better than having a bathroom equipped with head cheese and sardines and a kitchen equipped with squatty potties.
Yeah, although the humping the foam roller, I don't care where you do that.
You can do that anywhere.
That's always going to freak you out.
Freak out! Freak out! And you can get all the information for this episode over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/279, including links to everything that we talked about. Be sure to, of course, grab the brand new book if you haven't yet. 480 pages of absolute goodness over at beyondtrainingbook.com.
It'll hold your door open like nothing you've ever owned.
That's right. And it's an excellent paperweight. Mm-hmm. So check all that out. And until next time, have a great week.
Visit BenGreenfieldFitness.com for even more cutting-edge fitness, nutrition, and performance advice.